This podcast is brought to you by All Things Film. Awesome. No, it really is. All Things Film, the web's premier collection of independent movie and TV related podcasts. For more, check out www.allthingsfilm.co.uk or search All Things Film on iTunes, Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. And now, on with the show.
Welcome to Podcast on Fire and the Dynasty Report on Kung Fu Jungle and Rise of the Legends. And welcome back to this sub-series of Podcast on Fire. And this time we're tackling and discussing the 2014 high-profile, two 2014 high-profile productions. One is Kung Fu Jungle starring Donnie Yen and the latest movie featuring legendary folk hero Wong Fei-Hung is on the table. You know, no Jet Li this time around, but a new Wong Fei-Hung. So there'll be talks of how this reboot, if it can be considered that, we'll find out first, and it's called Rise of the Legend. So the Dynasty Report is where I sit back and listen to people who actually watch new movies that have an interest or semi-interest in what Hong Kong and the mainland offers up currently, and I'm the cynical bastard who finds little of interest in anything because I'm all retro and hipster and in that way. But the truth is I find little appeal in new action movies and whatever genre comes out of Hong Kong, or just spend my time watching other things. Crap. But this is the show where I can listen in to find out if there's any actual good movies out there. And I love listening to the team that I have here on the show discuss new movies, and they might, you know, their passion for it might trigger me to try out something new even tonight. So I will set aside, you know, Taiwanese movies and old Charlie Cho movies and Godfrey Ho Ninja pictures to listen in on the Doctor, David Lam, and Paul Fox live from Hong Kong discuss these two movies. So welcome, David Lam, and Happy New Year, because we just passed the Chinese Lunar New Year.
Oh, thank you. Happy New Year, everybody.
And as I said, live from Hong Kong, he's not sitting in the rundown, grimy cinema that we named this show after the Dynasty, but Paul Fox is here nonetheless, so say hi, buddy.
Yeah, hello, everybody, and happy year of the goat, sheep, or ram. Take your pick.
What's your preference, then?
I'm kind of partial to the sheep, but, you know, we've got some images of goats and rams, and there's a lot of discussion on that going on.
Right now, so. they'll keep people busy for a year until next Lunar New Year. Like, you know, Paul, tell the nice people what the Dynasty is again. And yes, we named it after it partly because it sounded cool, but, you know, it is a cinema in Hong Kong, but why is it in your eyes and your friend's eyes so so legendary? Do you recommend going there, maybe armed? Just in case.
no need for arms. It's in a perfectly safe, you know, most of Hong Kong is perfectly safe. You could go there and watch a midnight film. I don't even know. I don't think they do midnight films anymore. But you could easily watch a midnight film there with no trouble whatsoever. But it is an older theater in the context of the theaters that we still have remaining in Hong Kong. Now, my co-host on my other program, Kevin, has informed me that it's not really traditionally an old theater, that it was kind of built in somewhere in the 80s, 90s. But it's still one of the few remaining sort of sole independent theaters in Hong Kong. And it is a little bit kind of run down. You go in and you can actually see like one of the screen sections has been replaced. So it's slightly different shade of white than the others. And, the seats are old. It's not stadium seating. They get a little bit uncomfortable if the movie's more than 90 minutes. People go in there and smoke. You can bring your own food, you know. But normally, it's got a nice atmosphere for watching local movies, and it's a place that I love and it's very close to my heart. So, yeah, if you like watching Hong Kong films and you ever get a chance to go to Hong Kong, just look up the Dynasty Theater. It's in Mong Kok. It's very easy to get to, very easy to find. You know, the staff there is very friendly. They don't care if you're foreigner, or if you're a local Chinese or whoever, and you know, it's a good place to watch local movies, and it's never very crowded.
Is it even a, not that this is a must for modern cinemas, but is it even a 3D cinema that's not far away from the Dynasty? Like, they can't afford to do that.
No, they do. I mean, they showed Sex and Zen 3D there, And, you know, they'll show stuff in 3D. Now, the system they use is a little bit different than, because there's like two or three 3D systems. So they have glasses that are different from the other cinema circuits. And their glasses are not quite as comfortable, I've found, to wear. So, but I hate 3D anyway, so.
It's just a few months. It's not quite, but it's not bad. You know, it's a good time, but it's not quite there, like with all the world's comforts and what have you. But yeah, David, do you have any sweet, like, old cinemas that you can still frequent over there in your part of the world?
Not for any Asian movies. I mean, there used to be one or two in Chinatown, and they were pretty grungy stuff. You know, they'd show like your typical crowd pleaser, and then it'd be paired with a category 3 film.
Yeah, that's a memory I can never have, because Hong Kong movies were never big to that extent anywhere. Even in the big cities, at best you got some festival play for select movies, but not like dedicated cinemas to that played the latest stuff, category 3 or not, so there you are. Sweden has never been a hotbed in terms of that, but we'll talk some current, not past memories, but some current memories in our discussion, in your guys' discussion of Kung Fu Jungle and Rise of the Legend, but we'll just run through some quick contact information. First of all, and this is Podcast on Fire at the Podcast on Fire Network. Our website is podcastonfire.com. You'll find this show. We have shows on various countries, cinema, Taiwanese, Korean, Japanese, and even sleazy cinema on that very site, podcastonfire.com. We also have bonus episodes on there. Email if you have any feedback. We would love to hear from you. podcastonfire@googlemail.com. We are present on Facebook. facebook.com/POF Network is our page. So please leave a like if you like our show. And join us over in the discussion group by typing in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search bar. Find show updates and chat about various things in there. And our Twitter handle is @PodcastOnFire. And as mentioned, my like movie tastes is what I kind of pour onto my website, SoGoodReviews.com. I review various Hong Kong movies, but the focus is on category 3, Taiwanese movies of the 70s and 80s mainly, and the occasional Godfrey Ho ninja picture starring Richard Harrison or whatever Westerner he had at his disposal. Ninja exploitation, Richard Harrison exploitation, if you will. And I video review at sleazykvideo.com, and my Twitter handle is @SoGoodReviews. Podcast on Fire is available on iTunes. Rate and subscribe if you're a podcast user, in terms of that's how you want your podcasts delivered to you. And if you have the time, please leave a written comment to us. We would love to hear from you over there as well, and to get some more reviews up on iTunes. And finally, if you don't have space on your device that you where you want to have podcasts, but you have so many pictures of food and cats together, if you don't have space, you can stream us via Stitcher Radio. They have an online presence, but the smoothest way to stream us is through their application, available on the Apple App Store and Google Play. And over to you, Paul. Your plugs, for reference sake, we mentioned you host a podcast, but in your own words, where are you on the web?
Yeah, you can find us over at Kongcast.com. That's KONGCAST.com. And pretty much anything I'm doing currently is going to be popped up over there.
Right on. And as we said in the prior episode, East Screen, West Screen has returned as kind of East Screen only, but it's still a return nonetheless too. And you're churning out episodes quite effectively. Good to have you back and all of that. David, you have some presence out there on the web, so want to plug anything?
Yes, I've been throwing all my artwork on Twitter, so follow me at taijuppie.com. Sorry, at Thai Yuppie.
Right on. Where does that come from? Thai Yuppie. Yuppie.
That is a Wong Kar Wai reference. That's the character Leslie played in Days of Being Wild.
Never seen that. So I can't judge it. But when I see it, I will. You know, I'm not the biggest Wong Kar Wai fan. I love Ashes of Time, but no one else seems to love Ashes of Time, though.
When are we going to do a Wong Kar Wai series? When is that going to happen, Ken?
Be like, poke me. Like, I'll do it if you abuse me enough and you call me names, David, and I will do it. Like, yeah, I'll do it. What?
All right, noted.
Ashes of Time, wonderful. I'm not gonna watch Chungking Express again. And we've kind of done it on the show already way back in the day. So, I'll give anything a chance that I haven't seen. Days of Being Wild, I haven't seen. In the Mood for Love, I haven't seen. Happy Together, I have seen. I don't want to see again. So, there you go.
Have you seen The Grandmasters, Ken?
Nope.
Yeah. If you like Ashes of Time, that's one I'll recommend for you, because I'm not a big Wong Kar-wai fan. And like you, I've seen the films you've listed, and I don't need to see many of them again. I'd watch Ashes of Time again, and The Grandmaster, I think, is worth a rewatch. So I think if that's a film, it seems like you have the same sensibilities as me. If that's a film you enjoyed, Ashes of Time, then I think you'll find things to like in The Grandmaster.
Good, because I like Ashes of Time as this big thing to untangle, but it has depth and nuance, and the challenge is always welcome.
I recommend my Blueberry Nights.
Do you really? Because no one else seems to do it. No one else seems to like it, though. Do you like it in actuality?
I'm not even sure you can count that as an official Wong Kar-wai film.
Why not?
But
his name is on it.
Yeah, that's true. He never talks about it. I don't think anybody talks about it. Rightfully so, but...
Do you think it rather like steer the subject onto, hey, I wrote Haunted Cop Shop once, we're gonna talk about that? Like, okay, never talk about that. This is a good opportunity. We can talk about like this, the cool stuff he wrote prior to being a director. Okay, that's cool.
Yeah. Jude Law's pretty dreamy in it, so, you know.
Well, isn't he always? You know? but all right. That's it. You know, it's on wax now, so to say. So let's try and do it. I can't like guarantee that I can say anything about it, because I might not understand Days of Being Wild, if you will. But so I'm not going to be like art. It's what I think of art. That's my review. Bye. I'm not going to do that. Okay, that's some good fun out of the way. Let's have some more fun after the podcast promo break. So listen to a promo from one of our friends in the podcast community and support their show if you find the promo to be to your, if you find it appealing. So that's a long-winded way of saying, let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Smithy, you've got to come back with me.
Where?
Back to the future.
Wait a minute. What are you doing, Trev?
I need fuel. Go ahead, quick, get in the car.
Oh, no. I just got a new copy of Evil Dead, and I'm watching that tonight.
We'll bring it along. It can sense that too.
Wait. What happens to us in the future?
No. Both you and your Evil Dead collection turn out fine. As your kids, Smith, something's got to be done about our kids. They team up and do their own movie podcast. They hate Evil Dead and Back to the Future. We'll have to show them how a funny and informative podcast is really done.
Well, Trev, you better back up. We don't have enough road to get up to 88.
Roads?
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Listen to Mass Movieside UK. Available every Sunday by iTunes, Stitcher, and all good podcast outlets. Your jacket is not dry.
So, welcome back. And now I'm going to shut up for the most part. I'm going to butt in whenever I have a question. I have prepared some questions. But mainly, I'm going to sit back and listen to, as I said, people talk about recent movies that I have no prior interest in. I had no interest in watching them when they were announced and when they were released. But maybe the discussion between Paul and David will trigger something. So we'll start with Kung Fu Jungle. I think you have some plot and some setup for us, Paul. So the floor is yours. Take it away.
All right. Thank you. So yes, Kung Fu Jungle. This is the latest film from Donnie Yen, a name I think many listeners to this program should recognize. And this came out, I want to say, October 30th or 31st in 2014. And you may have heard people talk about the previous Donnie movie on another episode of the podcast on Fire Network with much scorn and much disregard. So we're going to get into how this movie compares with that previous movie, which was Iceman, of course. Before I do any of that, though, let's do a quick synopsis of the film. So this is a story about murder, the murder of a martial arts master, which prompts a convicted kung fu expert named Ha Hao Mo, played by Donnie Yen, to seek release. He's incarcerated. And he seeks release to assist the Hong Kong police in tracking down the killer, played by Wong Bao Chang. And he continues his spree of challenging and killing top masters, with the police and Mo seemingly one step behind him all the way. But as the investigation continues, it's revealed that Mo may actually know the killer, and his reason for seeking release may not be as sincere as he originally led on. That kind of sets the plot synopsis up. Basically, I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give too much away. And I think before I get too far into my own thoughts on the film, I'm going to throw the ball over to the doctor and let him talk about it.
I think Kung Fu Jungle is probably the most Donnie Yen movie since Ip Man and Flashpoint. And to me, I think Donnie's most effective when he's not playing the most confident or the smartest guy in the room. I mean, Donnie is at his best when he's defined by his physicality rather than his personality.
Would you say, David, therefore he's gotten roles where he's... what am I trying to say? That he's trying to come off as way too cool and he can't measure up to that? Or what's been like the bad Donnie Yen roles?
Iceman is probably really bad Donnie Yen when you can tell he's striving for something. Uh-huh. Special Idea is another case where he's trying to do too much, you know? Like, I mean, there are actors who are good at becoming chameleons, and then there are actors that are just good at playing themselves. And Donnie Yen is, you know, the latter. He is Donnie Yen. Just don't ask him to do anything else, acting wise. I mean, just.
But then Ip Man still came along because Andy received acclaim, as far as I know, for at least the first movie. I don't know how the second fared critically, but that is obviously a character that you need to honor in a distinct way. So, but you thought that was very workable. He made that role his own.
Yeah, because that character, I believe, is very similar to his persona anyway. So he's not required to do a lot with Ip Man. He's just required to be stoic, you know, charismatic, and perform the action scenes the way he does it. And, you know, that's, to me, is Donnie in a nutshell. Like, don't ask him to do too much when it comes to acting or character development.
But do ask him to break dance, because he can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, so Kung Fu Jungle, you know, I mean, if you compare it to Iceman or Special ID, it's almost like a masterpiece, I would say. On its own, it's pretty decent entertainment, you know, and that's all I require from Donnie. Like, I just want him to make movies where he's having fun, but not as much fun as Iceman, where everybody is excluded.
I gotta say, I haven't seen it, but I judged this movie kind of before. When I heard the title and knew it was a modern movie, then I thought, like, is this a working title? Kung Fu Jungle? Mm-hmm. But I'm guessing, like, they're going for an urban feel, and it is a Kung Fu movie per default. The plot even sounds like it could be transferred to a dynasty period, and it would, you know, it's not unlike an old school martial arts movie plot-wise. So I'm guessing now that the movie's kind of formed and with us, then the title seems more spot-on, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I think the concept is rather ingenious. You know, it takes a very archetypal kung fu kind of setup and then, you know, transpose that to like a modern sensibility. And most of it works. You know, when I first saw the trailer, I really thought it was going to be kind of a Silence of the Lambs mixed with Game of Death kind of thing. And that was very intriguing to me.
Some inherent darkness then, I suppose.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess it almost promised in the trailer a darker Donnie too. And, you know, I don't know what a darker Donnie is, like, but it seemed intriguing. So, and the movie kind of lives up to the expectations a little bit. It kind of, midway through, it kind of drops those pretensions and it becomes more of a straightforward action film.
I definitely agree with David that the trailer is a little bit, I don't want to say deceptive, but I had that exact same feeling when I watched the trailer, that this was a Donnie, because the way they play the trailer off, it's like they use very specific scenes and mm-hmm. a couple reaction shots from Donnie that make you think he's like playing a game. So you do get that very sort of like, is this a sort of more of a thriller kind of a thing than an action movie? And again, it's wrong to say the film's deceptive, but it doesn't really go as full bore as I think it could have. I think if it would have gone in that darker direction, it probably would have been an even more interesting film than it already is. I mean, as it is, it's a good action film. The film is actually an homage to action film and filmmakers from Hong Kong. And it does that through this kind of long set of credits at the end where it's paying homage to the people who worked on this film. A lot of those people are people that you probably never heard of unless you pay a lot of attention to filmmakers. It does highlight some action stars, and they've got a lot of, for example, televisions are always on in this movie. And always on the television is another movie. Sometimes they're classic movies, sometimes they're more recent films. Like there's a scene where Seven Swordsmen, right? With Liu Kalang, right? His scene where he's fighting, and then he shows up in the credits. He's not in this movie except on that secondary screen, right? But they're sort of paying homage to these people. And there's just a long cast list of cameos. You know, David / he's credited as John. John Chang is in the movie, you know, in a small role. You know, lots of people are thrown in here, sometimes just popping up. Not all of them are in action roles. Yeah, they're really trying to highlight not the big names who were just actors, but people who were behind the scenes a lot. And I think that, you know, doing that is kind of hard to say, you know, point fingers at the film, you know, because they had this kind of noble intention with the film. But I do think the setup is actually pretty interesting. And Ken, you're very right in that this is a film that the narrative is taken straight out of, you know, classic martial arts movies. You know, somebody going around killing masters, who's doing it, you know, challenging masters and murdering them. And
you know what the excellent thing would have been, like, to really make it an homage? To have the bad guy wear a mask throughout the movie, and then an ending reveal where he pulls off the mask, not in a comedic way, but like really go for a genre staple. That sounds cool in my head anyway.
Well, there's a point where, for me watching this film, I was unsure if the Wang Bao Chang character was real or not, because they do one of the things cinematographer standpoint, to where a lot of times when he's on screen, he's not on screen with any other people. So it's, you know, maybe that's too much of a spoiler here, but they, you know, it is still pretty much a straight up, you know, kind of hunt the bad guy down kind of thing. It like David said, it has that potential to go much further, but they chose not to really go that way. They wanted just to kind of stick with the action.
Wise decision to stick with the action, you think?
Well, given what they were trying to do, again, yes, I think so. You know, because they wanted to make this, you know, a love poem or a love song to Hong Kong martial arts film. And as that, I think it works quite well. The problem for me, though, was that by setting it in the modern sort of urban Hong Kong setting, it actually weakens itself. I think that this would have been a much stronger film had they made it a period film, though I know we've seen it done in period pieces before. Because the problem is that when you have a guy going around killing people with his fists, and then you make it into a chase and you have police involved, so there, it's kind of like it's got that detective aspect. It starts to fall flat because it doesn't take into account the aspects of modernity, which we all know are there. So we have to, for me, I had to suspend my disbelief a little bit too much. You know, I mean, street cameras, snipers, tear gas, modern detective work, and basically guns everywhere. I mean, okay, yeah, both of them are excellent martial artists, but there's a point, you know, whereas Iceman, it's so ridiculous and over the top, you go, okay, anything goes. Right? Exploding poop in toilets. Okay. You know, anything goes at that point.
I like that.
But with this, they're trying for that level of realism. You know, nobody's shooting like Street Fighter 2 fireballs and stuff like that. They're trying to set this up as a very sort of gritty, realistic martial arts film. So by doing that within the bounds of modern technology, I think I found myself trying to suspend my disbelief in places that didn't really work. And what ends up happening is that the police here come across as Keystone cops, basically.
Yeah, they're pretty incompetent. You know,
they are very, very incompetent. And, you know, at one point, they've gotten Donnie Yen's character out of jail, and he's basically told them, all right, this guy is doing this. He's going around challenging these top masters. He knows who they are, right? They know that it's like five or six guys. They know. So they go to – they figure out – they use some kind of martial poem to figure out the order he's going in to kill these guys. So they go to the next guy, right? It's not like the Hong Kong police force is small. They could have sent units to watch all five or six of the guys at once, right? But they're trying to chase him to the next guy instead of getting all the guys under surveillance at one time. You know, so it's things like that that just make me scratch my head and go, okay, they're pursuing this down a linear path for narrative sake, and it's not, it's a little bit nonsensical in points. But again, yeah. I'm nitpicking here because, again, it's nowhere near as nonsensical as Iceman.
Well, there's even a scene where Donnie ditches like the police. He just disappears, and they don't know where he is.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, okay, yeah. I mean, a big city like Hong Kong, sure, okay, that I can see. But some of the others, I mean, you know, they've got SWAT teams at certain points, and, you know, it's like nobody can shoot straight, and, and you know, there's no other kind of surveillance going on, and it's just, there's just a bit too, it becomes a bit too superhuman at some points. And some other, you know, things that just, all right, so for example, there's a fight with a sword master who's played by, Louis Phan, Phan Siu Wong. And he's basically, it's interesting because he's playing like an actor, a superstar, but he's also this master. So he's kind of like Donnie, right? He's like master turned superstar. Mm-hmm. And he's on set and they're filming a scene. They got a full crew there. And so the killer shows up and like goes out, interrupts the scene, and he's there to challenge him. And he does a couple things that show that he's a bad dude, right? You don't want to mess with him. And the whole crew just runs away, right? Everybody's just gone. Nobody calls the police. Nobody breaks out a mobile phone to start recording what's going on. I mean, I'm telling you, in Hong Kong, anything happens on the street and you've got 10, 12 people with their mobile phone recording it, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's violent instead of protest. You know, somebody's going to be recording. Now, this full film crew, boom, they're just gone. And so it's just, you know.
They thought they were filming a scene, maybe.
No. They knew the scene was over. And, you know, no triad guys show up, you know, saying, oh, this is on our turf. You don't mess around here, right? None of that happens. So moments like that, I think, kind of bring the film down, but not enough to ruin it by any means.
Is it like the comedic tone is not this huge contrast versus the dark tone, right?
Yeah, no, there's not a – it's I mean, it doesn't really go for comedic beats at all. It's trying to play it straight. It's just in doing so, it has to make the police look dumb, and it has to make other things a little bit nonsensical that you'd go, well, all right, that really wouldn't happen. And there are things, I mean, from a writer's perspective, I would think they could have worked around that, right? You instead of having him challenge, you know, the Louis Phan character on a full set, it's like, all right, he's just left the set and he's alone. And, you know, there are things they could have done, I think, to narratively fix it, but for whatever reason they didn't. Maybe they thought it was cooler just to have the whole crew run away or something. Even these nitpicks that I'm throwing at the film don't make it a bad film. It's still a very, very good and enjoyable action film. At its core, though, if some people are familiar with the, it's an old 1970s film by Ridley Scott called The Duelists. Where Keith Carradine and Harvey Keitel spend the film kind of going back and forth, you know, challenging each other. This film kind of has a vibe like that, you know, because it's about these two sort of, you know, top masters. And as things unfold, you come to understand the relationship a little bit more deeply. And so, you know, in that essence, it's still very, very interesting. But I do think that this would have been a better film, as I said, had it been set in the old era, because then you don't have to worry about the guns and the cameras and all that stuff. You can have a guy burst into a room with 20 people and show that he's, you know, a bad dude and have those 20 people run out. And it makes more sense in the context of the setting.
Would we really need another period piece? Because it seems period piece versus modern action is the period piece is more popular nowadays. So what's your take on that? I mean, isn't it better that they favor modern a little bit more?
Yeah, what would set it apart?
I think that it just the nature of the fact that it's a good work versus a bad work would set it apart. You know, it's like if they could have set this in sort of like a Detective D style setting, I think would have been amazing. It's obviously cheaper to do it in a modern setting, you know. So there are pros and cons to both sides. But I think that in doing it, again, they probably needed to spend more time writing to try and work around some of these, you know, narrative flaws. You know, Charlie Young is sort of the head of the investigation as the police captain. She's just got a thankless role.
Again? I mean, what's going on there? Like, first Floating City, new police story, way back though. But, like, that's a terrific actress. Use her well, for heaven's sake.
And all she really does here is angry acting in the scene she's in. And because, you know, she keeps looking incompetent throughout. And I think it's again, an unfair role down that comes down to the writing, not anything to do with her or her performance.
Yeah, yeah.
But beyond all that, okay, you got to get down to the action. And the action is, you know, true, top-notch spectacle. Wang Baoqiang, he gets a majority of the screen time. So while this is technically a Donnie movie, actually, he's doing a lot of the action work. He's fighting these, you know, these different masters throughout the movie. And for the most part, it's his film as sort of a nice showpiece for what he can do. Mm-hmm. I think with his character, though, what doesn't really work for me is the motivation, because when it gets down to why he's doing what he's doing, I'm just like, really? That's what all this is about, is just that's it. It just seems like it's not that believable for me that he goes this far, you know, based on what they show happening. And I don't want to give too much away because I don't want to, you know, put out too many spoilers. But, you know, in terms of once things get going and the ball gets rolling and he starts having some showdowns with these other actors and finally with Donnie, it makes it all worthwhile, you know, because that's what we come to look for.
He's not a martial artist, is he?
I think he is. I think
is
I don't know a lot about. He's done. I think he did I Love Wing Chun. He's done martial roles. He's done non-martial roles too. He's gotten some notoriety for some comedies and some dramas and stuff. But I think he's got some martial training.
Was in Iceman 3D as well?
Yeah. He was one of the time travel brothers.
He's pretty convincing in this movie, I think.
Yeah, he's very convincing. I mean, he's not a big guy, but he's able to use physicality in a way that makes it, you know, combined with the way they shoot it and the cinematography, that makes him look powerful. And while there is some CG, and I think that David has a couple comments on the CG, for me, the CG here was nowhere near as offensive as the CG in Iceman, which I just found deplorable. That fight scene on the bridge, I was just like, really? Why are you wasting my time?
Yeah, well, first of all, this wasn't 3D, I assume. So there's like an element that's thankfully gone, because obviously 3D elements are going to stand out like a sore thumb when it's coming at you.
I'm kind of surprised it's not 3D. It's kind of shot for 3D. I think there's some scenes where, you know, it'd be perfect for the 3D stuff.
Yeah, I think I'm glad they didn't focus on that.
Let me ask you this, because this is a major selling point for me if I'm going to watch this movie or not. The action, okay? Mm-hmm. So the basic question is that I have for you, and then I'm going to go on a little rant what I don't like about current action. So we'll go around the room after I ask as an interested party. So think about this while I speak about my views on action. Is the action shot in a stable way, handheld, or very quick cut? Okay, so focus on that, because in my eyes, the few modern movies I watch, be it a Western or an Eastern movie, stable action, i.e. shot with a fixed camera and fairly long takes, that's rare. And even somewhat stable action nowadays that is slightly handheld still turn me off, because I'm still in that like 70s and 80s, 90s style in a way that appeals to me more, and the modern style does not appeal to me. Because I was so delighted when I saw a movie like Gallants, which is, yes, an homage to the veterans that were in Gallants, but also to how action was shot by the likes of Lau Garlong and Yuen Wo Ping and what have you, with a stable cameras, but it was done by young directors that let veterans work very well, and they were allowed by the commercial system to shoot it that way. It was not just a retro movie, but it's a choice that in my mind I would like to see in more modern movies. But I realized that that is not the appealing choice for new audiences, and I am a different kind of audience that prefer my style of action in a certain way. You know, I even like, I know this sounds horrible and I'm taking it out of context. I watched part of a fight scene in The Raid 2. And The Raid is beloved, both 1 and 2. And I love that any action movie can create a buzz. And I love that Donnie Yen can create a buzz when his movies come out. And I watched that scene in The Raid 2, and it's not very shaky, but it's enough shaky for me where I can't get into the impact that Lao Gollum scene, for instance, gives me. But then again, if you fast forward to the 90s wuxia trend, that meant a lot of quick cutting, the various Choi Hawk movies that Donnie Yen also appeared in. A lot of the wire work was fantastical and quick cutting there as well, but I like the feel and style more, and modern action rarely gets me going, which might be my problem, but I know what I prefer, and that means I'm just making my choices and not judging current choices. But coming back to the question in terms of how this action is shot in Kung Fu Jungle. So David, in your estimation, is it clear, handheld, and quick cut, or what's the style of action we're getting here?
I think it's pretty clean, straightforward camera work. I don't think there's a lot of handheld. It's definitely frenetic, but the action is always, you know, very clear, easy to follow. And it's funny you mentioned The Raid 2, because for me, I think there's a direct homage to The Raid 2 in the opening sequence of this movie, where it's Donnie in prison and he's kind of fighting a number of people all at once. And, you know, that is shot in a pretty concise way too. So, I mean, there's no complaints on my end regarding the action. Everything is, you know, just really straightforward, but done in a way that's competent and exciting to watch.
I'm kind of in the same boat with you. If something's too much shaky cam, mm-hmm. and I can't see what's going on, it sticks out in my mind. And that didn't happen in this film. So I can't say with any certainty that they used, stationary cameras in most of the fighting scenes, but I felt I had a good view of what was going on. You know, mm-hmm. that the choreography was very clear. It was understandable from shot to shot. I think there were some cuts in places, but it wasn't, super MTV style cutting.
You know what was a good example of a modern movie doing it well? That was SPL. Again, another mm-hmm. Donnie movie, yeah. Really well shot, and it lets the action flow for an extra second or two. That wasn't just like a retro thing to do for an old fart like me. Like, it was really like a good merger of modern and slightly old-timey sensibilities, if you will.
Yeah, and I think that they don't try and do a lot of fancy CG cinema techniques to make up for things, which, mm-hmm. you know, we will talk about in our second film today. I do think that, the movie that pops out in my mind whenever I think of the absolute worst in terms of shaky cam fight scenes is one of the Bourne movies. I don't remember which one, but he was like having a fight scene with a guy in a house in a bathroom or something. And I just remember sitting there the whole time, you know, watching. I'm thinking, I can't understand a single thing of what's going on in terms of this scene. You know, it's like I'd rather not be watching it because it's just...
I heard the choreography originally as conceived was great by someone who knows the choreographer. And then director and cinematographer stepped in and shot it their way rather than trusting the action director.
And yeah, I think that that's probably more often than not the case because, you know, I think action choreographers want their action to be seen and to be understood and you know, they want that to be translated well, and you just throw in camera technique that ruins it. But I never had that sense here. I mean, there's some things that, you know, kind of struck me as like, all right, guys, like there's a scene towards the end where the protagonist, the antagonist are fighting, and suddenly a bamboo scaffolding truck crashes right next to them. So now there's all these convenient bamboo poles, you know, to suddenly be used, right? It's like, all right, okay, so yeah, you've kind of thrown in a couple narrative crutches there so that we can see some variety in the action, right? That it's not always just fist, fist, fist. You know, beyond that, I think that in terms of how it was shot, how it was choreographed, it was all very easily comprehensible and it translated easily well. Very well with the cinematography.
And you got a veteran director at the helm here. We forgot to mention that this is directed by Teddy Chen, the director of Alien Wife. But general audiences, of course, Bodyguards and Assassins. Wait Till You're Older, Purple Storm. In the Heat of Summer is one of my favorite movies from him. It's like third movie in the night. It's really, really good cop drama. Jordan Chan and Jack Cow and a variety of other people. So good, competent director, which was kind of struck me as sort of confusing when I read the title, all the pre-nonsense that I talked about. Kung Fu Jungle, Teddy Chen. The title sounds crap. What is Teddy Chen doing on this? But that is obviously my fault of prejudging it in a moment without seeing a frame of it.
I'll come to your defense, and I think it's a stupid title. Okay. I really do. It doesn't translate out from anything to do with the actual Chinese title, which is like...
Yeah, I have the literal translation on Hong Kong Movie Database, The Martial Arts World of One Person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kung Fu, you know, Rumble in the Jungle, I don't know. It's not a title that conveys a sense of this movie at all, I think, you know. And that's perhaps a big failing for the film is the title. Yeah. But actually, you know, don't think about the title when you go watch this movie.
It's also known as Kung Fu Killer.
Yep, UK title, Kung Fu Killer.
Yeah, they could have called it Kung Fu on Fire, right? Because, I mean, it's like, it's a prison movie and for a portion of it. So, you know, it's got that going on. They got the Browns on and everything, so.
Let me go back slightly to the director thing here. That, like, the parade of cameos, it sounds like. Was that, like too much or just fun to see Andrew Lau come in, David Chang, Kirk Wong, and Alex Chung, and Soi Chang is apparently in it as well. And was that fun, that parade for you, David, for instance?
I liked it.
Great thing is that for people who don't know these folks, you'll get to know them through this film because it does a very nice thing with this ending montage, this ending credit montage, in that it shows each of them on screen with their name. So, you know, you get a name associated with the face. So if you didn't know who Kirk Wong was before, maybe you knew him by name. Now you'll know who he is in the movie. You'll see him. You'll recognize him. You know, you won't recognize him you might not recognize him when that scene comes up, but you'll see him at the end and go, oh, okay, that's Kirk Wong. I know what he looks like now. I can now go back and look for him and other stuff.
He's a comfortable actor, though. I mean, he's down there. He's a great villain on the screen in various 80s and a 90s movie or two. So I always like when Kirk gets to be on screen. I think he's a villain in Long Arm of the Law 3 and has some memorable stuff in The Big Heat where his hand gets blown up and you see this bloody stump of a hand in that very violent movie. So and obviously a talented director, Kirk Wong, as well. But hey, like guys like Alex Chung, who's not like in the spotlight or anything, but he's a classic director, Cops and Robbers, Man on the Brink, and things like that. So I like the sound of not just bringing them in for like, hey, 1 second appearance, and then you can go, but rather like we're gonna stop and celebrate them for a few seconds, even post movie. And let me ask you one final question before I leave you alone. But possibly this doesn't sound like a movie that was 50% Hong Kong, 50% mainland movie. It sounds very rooted in Hong Kong as made and as a production as well. Would that be fair to say? So it's not like influenced by what you got to show in the mainland to get through the censors and what have you?
I can't say that fully because if you look at the production company, it is from Emperor, but it's also from a company called Beijing Silver Moon Productions. So while most of the cast, you know, has a lot of Hong Kong connections, you know, Wong Bao Chang is a recognizable mainland actor. The film, it seemed like that the majority of it was sync sound in Cantonese, but they do, there is a part of where the film goes up to the mainland for a bit and deals with some backstory there. And so, you know, and then you have Wong Bao-chang, he speaks Mandarin, and so he has Mandarin dialogue. So it does some back and forth.
But not in this, like, disruptive way where they're clearly doing everything in their power to please censors. It doesn't sound disruptive, if you will.
It didn't stick out to me in my mind that this was a mainland-friendly film, but I guess at the end of the day it kind of is when you look at how things kind of end up and what happens to certain characters and then the message at the end. I mean, it all kind of fits nicely, you know, so there is that. And again, this takes us back to David's point on, you know, how the trailer kind of shows this as being a slightly darker thing, and then it turns out not to be that. Perhaps if it had gone that route, then they wouldn't have gotten screen time in China. So, you know, that's another thing to consider. One final point that I do want to mention, the end credit sequence, when they're doing this visual homage, they are playing the Chinese song Daring General, which is a very sort of recognizable theme, martial arts kind of style music that they play. They've played it in lots of movies in the past, and it's associated, like, going all the way back to, I think, like, some some black and white stuff. It's a theme that's been around for a long time. You can actually hear this theme. It's on the Kung Fu Hustle soundtrack. You can look for Daring General, and if you've seen a lot of martial arts movies, you probably heard it at some point in time. You'll recognize it immediately.
The working title for Kung Fu Jungle was supposed to be Last of the Best.
Oh, sweet. I like that. That's not too bad. I like that. It's like, it almost makes you think.
And lastly, I'll leave you with this. Donnie Yen is currently listed as being 5'9 on the interwebs. Same height as Aaron Kwok, so think about that.
I don't think I've ever seen Aaron Kwok and Donnie Yen in the same room, so.
And Aaron Kwok is going to be the new Monkey King.
Wait a minute. A sequel to the Donnie Monkey King or another production?
Yep, sequel to the Donnie movie.
But wasn't Aaron Kwok in the Donnie movie?
Yes.
He was.
But now he's going to...
He was the Bull King.
Yeah.
Well, it's hardly surprising. I mean, Hong Kong cinema has been doing this for decades. Like, hey, you're in one movie, we kill you at the end, like, viciously, we shoot you and dismember you. You're in the second movie, totally. You know, a week later when we release the sequel, you're in that movie. You know, it's no surprise that we even discussed that, Paul, on the God of Gambler's episode, that when Charla Cheung appears in God of Gambler's Return as Chow Yun-Fat's wife, which she also was in the first movie, but she plays a different wife, no big deal for the local audience. They're like, hey, there she is again. There's the Aaron again. That's sweet.
But there's no way that Aaron is 5'9", right? Or Donnie's 5'9". Like, it's really baffling to me.
We broke David's brain.
Maybe with heels, right? Maybe in heels.
Kung Fu heels.
Interesting.
Kung Fu heels on fire. All right, Don. And availability, it seems this is going on a global offensive, as we both have Hong Kong DVD and Blu-ray. We have a UK release, as said, as Kung Fu Killer. And I don't know if it's a DVD and Blu-ray now off the top of my head. I think it's slated for a US release as well, whether on disc or streaming. So it's not going to be hard to get this, whether on digital or physical. So there you are. And as Paul said, you can rent it on at least the Hong Kong iTunes. But I assume it's if it's available in further territories, there's a good chance that a site like iTunes will feature it in your territory. Maybe it is already on the UK iTunes. So the point is, it's going to be out there. It's not a rare one.
Yeah, and if I could just, in talking about video for just a moment, if you're somebody like me who's very selective in their buying of Blu-rays, that is, you don't have to own everything on Blu-ray, I would say that this film does qualify for a Blu-ray purchase because it does look very pretty in some of the, again, some of the fight sequences and some of the shots. There's some very good cinematography going on, and I think it would translate well over to Blu-ray players. I watched the HD version that I rented, so I was very happy with the quality and the look of it. So if you're somebody who's always on the fence about whether something should be a Blu-ray purchase or, you know, that HD purchase, I think that this is a film that falls on that side of the fence.
Let's take another promo break, and then it's time to talk of the Wong Fei-Hung reboot. And I'm not sure it got a lot of hype, at least in Western eyes, but I did know of it. So, I mean, there's that it reached me, at least, that another Wong Fei-Hung movie is coming. So we'll talk of Rise of the Legend of a Guy's Will from 2014 after the promo break.
If you like westerns, comedies, foreign films, horror movies, action adventure, and classic cinema, well, we don't have much of that, but if you like ass, titties, farting, burping, puffy nipples, poop, taboo porn, muffin tops, comic books, wrestling, mustaches, pie smashed on butts, cheese, taking baths, butt sex, gagging, milk, and the American flag, check out the Silva and Gold podcast. We're the morons your mom warned you about while she was sitting on your face.
Silva and Gold. We talk about movies and shit. Find us on iTunes or silvaandgold.com.
Welcome back, and the second review of this Dynasty Report is Rise of the Legend from 2014. As I said, another... well, it's the first in quite a while movie about Chinese folk hero Wong Fei-Hung, as essayed by Jet Li prior. So, but I'm not going to talk too much about it. Let's Paul take us into the discussion with some background and plot, perhaps. But anyway, the floor is yours.
All right. So, with Rise of the Legend, we have Yung Fei, played by Eddie Peng, who's rising through the ranks of the Black Tiger Gang, a vicious group that controls the docks in Qing Dynasty, southern China, identified as the Guangzhou Pearl River Delta area. The gang's leader, Lei Gong, is played by Sammo Hung. He takes Fei under his wing as his adopted son, and then he helps to eliminate a rival gang leader on the docks. But the Black Tiger Gang soon finds their dominance challenged by the Orphan Gang, who look to undo the evils of the Black Tiger Gang, and Fei Hung's motivations may not be all that they seem. So yeah, reboot of the Wong Fei-Hung franchise. But before I kind of, again, throw my spin on it, let me throw the ball back over to David.
Sure. You know, when I first heard about this idea, I thought it was pretty interesting. I do think it's time that Hong Kong cinema got some sort of franchise. And the Wong Fei-Hung franchise reboot is not a bad idea, I think. That certainly was intriguing to me, but I'm not sure if this was the movie I had in mind.
Let me just stop you there. Let's just briefly focus on the fact that people might irrationally react towards, like, hey, are they remaking Once Upon a Time in China? Whoa, how lazy. But what it's easy to forget is Once Upon a Time in China was a reboot.
Sure.
Because you'd had the Quan Tai Ing movies for eons and tons of them, and now all of a sudden you get Jet Li. He's too young in the role. You know, he can't play Wong Fei-Hung, but he rose to the challenge. The movie had a lot of genre vision, and it became a trendsetter, and it's no surprise that Choi Hak directed it. So, I mean, it's all how you execute, obviously. But so obviously, by the sound of it, this is not like a remake of Once Upon a Time in China 1. It sounds like it's going back to an actual young Wong Fei-Hung rather than this established, like, master of the Porcelain school, if you will.
It's definitely a hard reboot. You know, if you thought Jet Li was young, then you know, Eddie is probably a baby. The thing I'm not sure about is this movie kind of does what a lot of reboots do now. They kind of go a little bit too young for my taste. But I mean, you can consider this an origin story, so that's okay. I think Eddie Peng is a interesting actor. He shows, you know, glimpses of having more beneath the surface. But unfortunately, his performance here is more charismatic than, you know, than anything else. I really feel that it was kind of a one-note performance. And I'll say this, and I'll throw it back to Paul, but this reboot does something very, very similar to Kung Fu Jungle in that it tries to bring some modern sensibility to the kung fu genre. What it does is it stays within the time frame, but it still feels kind of anachronistic. There were times during the movie when I was watching it, I thought I was watching a triad movie, you know, a Young and Dangerous movie. It kind of has that appeal to it. I don't know if you agree, Paul.
I can see that now. Young and Dangerous, the prequel, kind of pops into my brain a little bit as you bring that up. You know, I agree that I think Eddie Pang looks great in the lead role here. He's already demonstrated that he can pull off physicality. We talked about, his film with Nick Chung, right? And he got into such great shape for that role. And you can see him training both on the screen, and you know he spent a lot of time training off the screen. And his physicality here is impressive. He's not, to my understanding, a trained martial artist in the way that, you know, Jackie Chan and or Jet Li or some of the others who have taken up the roles in the past were. There is a sense that, he's being brought on board not because of his skill in martial arts, though I would say he has some good, you know, action choreographers he's working with, but because he's a young, handsome, you know, hot actor.
Well, that brings up the point then. I'm curious about his trajectory. Has he proven himself as an actor, or is he more a popular actor, whether he's been in like quality productions? You mentioned the Nick Chung movie. I'm guessing that's Unbeatable, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He is I'll say this, I don't want to give too much of a spoiler away, but he makes a certain appearance in one of the Lunar New Year movies that at one time would have been reserved for celebrities of much larger status, we might say. You know, his star is rising, and he's getting a lot of you know, he's building his fan base in Hong Kong. I think he's built his fan base, you know, in China and in Taiwan as well. So, yeah, he's becoming a household name for, you know, but in part, I think it's because he's, you know, considered the handsome guy of the moment. Mm-hmm. I don't say that to take away from his acting ability, because I think he's been in some really good roles. And I think he's got, you know, really good acting chops. I don't mean to discredit him at all, but, you know, we see this happening, like David said, in other things which are getting rebooted, and where things tend to go with a younger cast. I'm thinking of things like Spider-Man and other things, you know, the casting of the previous Spider-Man, Andrew Garfield, as one example. There is a tendency to go younger, right? And so that's kind of what they're doing here. Now, that being said, I don't know if I'd say that Pang can't pull off Wong Fei-Hung, because there were moments in this movie, which means not the whole movie, but there were moments where I felt he was kind of doing it. The problem is not his. The problem is, for me, the script and the way the character's written. In part, my big problem with this film from the get-go was that it did not feel like a Wong Fei-Hung movie. And perhaps this is in line with what David was saying, where he thought it felt more like a triad movie. I can see that. A Young and Dangerous movie, I can see that. To me, this just felt like a period martial arts piece, you know, set during Qing Dynasty era, that is the same kind of setting that Wong Fei-Hung movies tend to take place. But as far as the characterization, it just didn't feel like this was Wong Fei-Hung for a long time. But perhaps I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. The film itself, I think, looks good, although it does tend to, the overall look tends to look washed out. And part of that, I think, is because there was so much CGI going.
For what reason, though? Because it's a period movie. Why the focus on CGI? I mean, a lot of, like, buildings in the background and stuff? Or?
Buildings in the background. You know, there's like overhead shots of like ships in the harbor and things like that. So it looks like one of those films where a majority of it is just done on green screen stages, and they're just throwing in lots of stuff, you know, and so it gives it that sort of gray greenish color that is indicative of a lot of these movies. For somebody coming to this movie new, you know, a new generation of kids who don't know the character from other films, I think they're going to like this movie. I really do. You know, we can look at other kinds of reboots and try and apply this logic. The Man of Steel reboot, You know, Batman Begins as a reboot versus the Tim Burton movies. You know, there's always a division based on expectations that people who were fans of some earlier incarnation had versus new fans coming into it, right? So I think that for younger generations who have not a lot of exposure with the character, this movie is going to work very well for them. And there hasn't, like, you know, there hasn't been a lot of Wong Fei Hung done since the 80s. You had, interestingly, Sammo Hung, who's the villain here, or the heavy. He actually played Wong Fei Hung in the movie Around the World in 80 Days back in 2004 as a cameo. The last time the character was on TV, he was played by David, a.k.a. John Chang, in a 2011 TVB drama called Grace Under Fire. It's mostly, the film focuses on Wong Fei Hung's wife, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. It's one that I haven't watched yet. But yeah, those are really kind of in popular culture the last two most recent emergences of the character. So it's time for a reboot, and I think people are kind of tired of Ip Man because we've had a lot of Ip Man, and I've discussed elsewhere where some of us feel that what they were trying to do with Ip Man was create a new Wong Fei Hung, basically, with you know, all the different interpretations of Ip Man, and none of which were really all that factual. You know, most of them being embellished upon in different ways, different aspects. To get into a Wong Fei Hung movie, a lot of it's got to be about the action. You've got a lot of action here. A lot of it's well done, dynamic scenes, but again, a lot of it is very stylized cinematically, because again, you don't have a lead who's a truly trained martial artist in the sense of a Donnie Yen or a Jet Li. So they're relying on camera work. They're relying on CG in some places. But overall, I think it's an okay mix. They do some slow motion stuff. You know, there's some stuff in the opening sequence, which is done in the rain. And so visually, it does try to get back to some of those things we're used to seeing in like the Jet Li movies and things. But it also has a look and a feel that's a little bit more in line with maybe some of the Matrix movies. In some ways,
can I be a judgmental prick for a little while? You describing the slow motion or what have you, that's exactly the thing that turned me off when watching the trailer, because I'm so sick and tired of seeing the same move used in so many movies where, and I guess we can sort of blame the Matrix, who did it well though, the move where the action slows down and then goes really fast again. Sick of it. Completely sick of it. And I don't know if it's like a studio decision to like get it in there because the modern audiences like it, man, or if it's just a lack of vision and imagination. But I dislike that move so much, and seeing it in that trailer made me go, I don't know about this movie. Maybe it's just one instance of it, but still,
there's a couple instances. I wouldn't say it's overly heavy-handed. I mean, they do have a mixture of different forms of action throughout. For me, I think the biggest offender was they have this final fight scene in a warehouse with Sammo, and the warehouse is on fire, and they end up going up into the rafters to fight. And I'm just thinking, okay, guys, heat rises. You guys are cooked gooses by now. I mean, come on. And the interesting thing is, you know, let's talk about another Wong Fei Hung movie, Iron Monkey, which interestingly enough, Donnie was in, playing Wong Kei Ying, Wong Fei Hung's father. From what I remember, there was a fight scene there where they were on poles and the poles were on fire, right? And I never got that sense of, you know, because it was kind of outdoors, out in the open. It wasn't a closed space. And I never lost my sense of believability in that sequence, even though it does some wire work and some stuff that's crazy. It didn't take me out of the moment. You know, I'm thinking, okay, these characters are bad dudes and they're up there on the poles and they're doing all this stuff and that's awesome. Here I'm just thinking, this is just so much CG in my face and it doesn't make sense because, you know, again, Sammo's going to be popping like a blood sausage. you know, and I think that sometimes they let the art direction and the visual sense take over from what common sense says maybe that's too much, or maybe they need to rein it in a little bit. I mean, you go back and you look at some of the Jet Li stuff that happened in warehouses that was more based on the action itself, on real, you know, stunt kind of action than the kind of the fancy visuals and green screen stuff. in part, I guess my point is that some of that gets in the way for me with this movie. You know, but let's get back to, aside from the action, back to the characters, Wong Fei-hung. You do have some supporting roles. You know, Wong Cho-lam, if you like him, he shows up here. If you don't like him, he shows up here. And that's going to impact a little bit of how you see the movie. He's playing a fairly famous character in the dynamic of the show, Big Tooth or Big Teeth,
yeah,
who was played by Jackie Chan in the original Once Upon a Time in China. Here, the character is a little bit different. So if you know the character from that film, it's a little bit different here and not really sure how I feel about him. I know that Wong Cho-lam is a popular sort of go-to person for cameos and for supporting roles here. And interestingly, he doesn't do Wong Cho-lam shtick.
Yeah, it's
pretty
reined
in. Which is a nice change, you know. And so with what he does, I think, all right, you know, he does an interesting little thing here. But as that character was written, I'm just like, I'm not sure if this is, you know, it's like rewriting Robin or rewriting, you know, another sidekick who you recognize certain things and you take certain of those things away. So he's a little bit different here. You also have Angela Baby as a prostitute or courtesan, as I guess they're called, who I tend to like a lot as an actress when she's given material to act with, but she really did nothing for me here in this role. They kind of try and sexy her up and you know, make her have some meaning as a potential love interest, love triangle kind of thing. But this is part of the problem with prequels, is the prequelitis. Okay, if by extension you kind of know where things are going to go as the character matures, you know, things happen, you know that this has no meaning. You know it's meaningless, all of this. And so again, that's a problem that comes down to a lot of the writing for this. Tony Leung Ka-fai is Wong Kei-ying, okay? An iconic martial arts character. Anybody who watches, spent a lot of time watching, you know, Shaw Brothers martial arts movies or reading about Kung Fu history or any of that stuff knows this character. Wong Kei-ying, as I said, played by Donnie in Iron Monkey, played by other actors before. I won't go into the list, but he's one of the 10 Tigers of Canton, and he's given such a very limited role here that it's almost, I was like, really, that's all you're going to do with this character? He's supposed to be this legendary character.
He's not much of a fighter too, right?
Yeah. Well, he's not given, we're not given much to see. And there's no real sense of his impact here, especially on Wong Fei-hung, his son, which, you know, you go back and you look at Iron Monkey and the moments between the two characters, you know, father and son, and the carryover of knowledge, not just martial arts training, but right and wrong and honor and these kinds of things, you know, and you expect that the father figure is going to have this big impact on the character. And none of that really comes through for me. This film is more about Wong Fei-hung and his friends, really. You know, the peer pressures and these kinds of things, I guess, and in part his relationship with Sammo.
Guys, let me ask you something, and maybe we can start with you, David. Do you think they're setting up for that they have believability, that they're setting up for themselves for a series here, like even before the tally of the box office and the critics and the reviews are out? I mean, can we expect, based on how this works, a second and third installment with Eddie Peng, you think?
Well, I think the intention is there. I mean, I think even the Young and Dangerous reboot, the intention was to kickstart another series, right? But whether or not it's going to happen is, you know, up in the air. For me, I don't think this was a strong enough showing to warrant another film, you know? But they're definitely setting up stuff. I mean, you don't see the entire repertoire of the Wong Fei-hung story there anyways. There's characters that haven't been introduced that, you know, I believe that they're saving. So who's to say?
And they're trying to, I mean, the one movie that kept popping in my head throughout watching this movie was Batman, especially sort of the reboot, you know, Batman Begins, the Nolan series. In that, what you have here is you have a character who's kind of trying to grip with the idea of being a hero and being honorable. you know, doing what's right, and yet they put him in situations and have him doing things that totally feel wrong for the character. I guess he's supposed to be a teenager, or, you know, like early 20s, maybe.
How old is Peng?
I'm not sure. I'd have to...
25? Yeah. So,
you know, I think cast-wise, Peng's fine, but I think the character of Wong Fei-hung, you know, he's doing this role that is so out of character for, I mean, what we've been shown for this character. I mean, in any incarnation, you look at, you know, the Jackie Chan versions, you look at the Jet Li versions, you look at other versions, and this character has always been about, you know, honor and righteousness and making mistakes, but, you know, generally doing what's right. But here he's more like Infernal Affairs, you know, it's like,
yeah.
It just doesn't seem like this would be the route that he would take. This would be the way that he'd do things. And for me, that's why it doesn't really feel like, you know, a Wong Fei-hung movie. It feels just like a movie, because you don't have that influence from the father. You don't have these strong motivations that are associated with the character. You know, we never see Wong Fei-hung the healer, right? Which is always something that's kind of portrayed. He's a martial artist, but he helps people. He heals people. He knows medicine, right? And again, maybe that's something to come in the second movie or the third movie, you know, down the road, something that they will get to.
I know this was nominated, at least Eddie Peng was, but how was it? A medium-sized box office or even strong box office? Do you guys remember that just offhand?
Yeah, I couldn't. I don't have the figures for this anywhere close at hand. I just know it was kind of strongly anticipated, but reviews were lukewarm when it finally hit. As a movie, again, this is why I say, if you're new, if you don't know this character, if you have no exposure to this character and you go into this movie cold, you'll probably like this movie a lot. Because as a martial arts period movie, the film works, and it works fine. It works well on some levels. But for me, as a Wong Fei-hung movie, it doesn't. They could have just created a new hero. You know, they could have called this guy, you know, I don't know, David Lamb.
Awesome. I like that.
But yeah, they could have just created a brand new hero set in this era. You know, I mean, they want to go with Wong Fei-hung because it's the brand name. You know, he was a real person. They don't, you know, they don't know a lot about him, but, you know, they do have connections and things. There's a museum in Foshan and everything you can go visit. You know, I think that had they just gone and said, we're just going to create a new guy, you know, for a new generation, not Wong Fei-hung, something else, you know, set it in this time period, and it would have been fine. It would have been okay. But if we go in with those, with that baggage of expectations, and again, this is the grumpy old man in me speaking.
I fairly agree. It's the remake syndrome again. Like, why remake Poltergeist when you can just do another ghost movie?
Yeah,
because that, okay, Wong Fei-hung is a stronger brand name than Poltergeist is, but it doesn't take much to just write something from scratch, from zero, because you have genre strength, ghost movie versus a martial arts movie in this case, that should be enough to get some market like buzz going. But hey, what do I know? I'm grumpy too.
Again, I'd say that on the scope of 2014 films, it's still one of the better films that's out there. As an overall film. But if you're a Wong Fei-hung fan, I think you're probably going to be pretty disappointed with this.
It all starts from the top, obviously, with the director, in a way, Roy Chow. And based on his three-movie strong filmography, which is Nightfall, Murderer, and this. Is this a... I know one of those is not very liked. Maybe both of them are not very liked. But, you know, to be very, very honest and provide some context, in your eyes, David, is Roy Chow a director on the rise to keep an eye out for, or has it been a shaky first three movies?
I have a lot to say about Roy Chow. I think he is probably making his way up to becoming, you know, on par with someone like Patrick Kong. I really dislike Roy Chow.
Just provide more context. Is Patrick Kong the, like, go-to director for romantic young adult type of dramas kind of thing?
Yeah. Steffi, Alex Fong, you know, romantic comedies with a twist kind of thing.
It's nobody likes, you know, nobody likes his movies. It's just not enjoyable for anybody.
No, that's not true. I like Patrick Kong.
Do you?
I do. I'm frequently, he's like a young Wong Jing for me. I'm frequently disappointed by his stuff, but I look forward to them. I really do.
It's like crack, essentially, right? Like, you do take it, but you kind of hate it too.
Well, getting back to Roy Chow, I think he's a very gimmicky director. I mean, now the three movies you listed from him have all hinged on some sort of gimmick. Like Murder was like, you know, I'm going to shock everybody with this ingenious script. What was the other one? Nightfall. You know, I'm going to have a central performance by Nick Chung where he plays a mute. Now you have this.
Michael Wong. Come on.
Yeah. I just, the verdict is out on Roy Chow. I think, I don't find him to be appealing. I think his sensibilities are all wrong. And the thing with this, what made this movie even harder for me to watch is that he takes that really, really tired, internal affairs kind of mole in trying to infiltrate this group kind of idea. And it's just, I'm so tired of that. I mean, if you've been following like Hong Kong movies and films, like it's a trope that's been used like forever now. It's just, it's very tiring to me.
And I think we have to point out too that this is a partnership of some sort, right? Because you have not only the director, you have the same writer, Christine Toh. Tho Chi Lung, who's on all three of the movies together with him. So they've formed this, you know, symbiotic bond as creators.
Sure.
And perhaps they are then subject to many of the same flaws where, you know, they have interesting ideas, but in some ways the execution is not there or some aspect of it ends up being off.
Yeah. Maybe it's Christine Toh. Maybe it's not even Roy's fault.
Oh, tread carefully, my friend. Tread carefully.
I mean, wow. She can take a break from writing scripts, you know, do something else.
You know, with experience, hopefully comes, increased experience, hopefully, increased, skill and what have you. I haven't seen any of the movies. I don't know. But in your estimation, Paul, is Roy Chow, is it like, is he there, or is it like, is it a downhill slide in a bad way? Three movies in, does he need to elevate his game hugely to matter?
You know, to be fair, looking at all three of his films, I'd say that for me, each one shows a sense of progression. In that, if I were going to rank them, this is his best film. Nightfall is second, and Murderer is way down at the bottom on third.
I don't know anything about Murder, but I know it's so disliked. And I'm always...
That's not true. I love it.
Okay. It's almost fascinating that, wow, that movie is hated. It's not like, meh, but rather like, fuck Murderer. Fuck it. I mean, it seems to have like a love-hate thing, even if David is the only one who loves it.
I've been begging to do a commentary for it for like the longest time now. Like, I just need someone to jump in on this with me.
I'm gonna say this.
I'm game. I'll watch it a second time.
Roy and any director, you know, just work, man, and develop your craft, regardless if, like, in my eyes, it's good craft or not with these three movies when I do get to them, if I get to them. But, you know, I would love to see anyone young, because he looks like a fairly young guy based on pictures, just get the opportunity to work and develop. And maybe small movies is a better way for him to develop, or maybe he finds his way making bigger movies like this. Because if you say this is his strongest movie, his best movie, maybe this is something he can tap into and make his own a little bit more than Murderer and Nightfall, which sounds like smaller movies, at least. I mean, I know they're modern movies, at least.
This is a bigger production, but you do have it being produced by Sammo, Ivy Ho, and so... Anytime you get a bigger production with those big names associated with it, it kind of makes me question how much the director is actually directing versus the producer actually coming in and running the show, you know. And again, I have no idea. You know, it would have been interesting to be a fly on the set to see, you know, is this a case of really Roy Chow, you know, building up? Because this is technically, I think it's got a lot more going on, and so. From that standpoint, it's a bigger film than his last two. You know, in terms of if he was actually in charge of the direction, if, you know, it wasn't Sammo calling the shots from from the sidelines and these kinds of things, then I think it shows some progress. But David, I got to ask. So, sure. How would do you rank Murderer as in the scope of the three films? Do you rank that as his number one, or
I rank Murderer as his most entertaining film, mm-hmm. and then it would probably be Nightfall. No, you know what? It'd probably be Wong Fei Hung and then Nightfall.
Okay, interesting. Yeah.
So Michael Wong didn't put it put Nightfall on top.
Yeah, he's probably the best part of Nightfall.
But to get back to Rise of the Legend, a little bit of availability. Is this available on disc in Hong Kong, Paul Fox?
Yeah, it's out there. It's on. They got the Blu-ray out there, and it's on the DVD, which is the version that I picked up. I don't know, because of the grayness of it, you know, that sort of gray-green look to it. And because there's so many CGI shots, some of them work. I mean, and when I say CGI shots here, I'm talking about landscape shots and things, mm-hmm. Things that normally you'd associate with, you know, nice images and cinematography. Because so much of that is fake, and it looks good, but you still know it's fake, and it's just kind of a grayish movie. I don't know if I'd recommend the Blu-ray route for this one. What would be your thought, David?
I think it looks pretty good, yeah. You know. Perhaps not Blu-ray, but my other question was: Eddie Pang dubbed in Cantonese, or is he just strictly Mandarin all the way?
I watched the Mandarin version because I figured, you know, it'd probably sync in Mandarin with him, and they just, you know, dub some of the other cast. So I haven't watched the Cantonese version, so.
Interesting.
But I did that. Now that I think about it, I think I tested it to see, and I think he did dub his voice in Cantonese.
Huh, interesting.
Let's just say Kung Fu Jungle got me like, yeah, that sounds pretty good. Rise of the Legend sounds like something I probably won't pursue personally. Not a slam on the movie. I love the discussion, but it just sounds like I'd rather watch my old Wong Fei Hung movies. That sounds more interesting from a character standpoint and all of that. So, but hey, that's possibly me being a bit judgmental, but that's what I think in my gut. So there you go. We are, I guess, done. We have no announcements for the next Dynasty Report. This is a sporadic show. We try to bring in two relevant movies, whether they were made a year ago or released a year ago or just released on disc or in the cinema. So there's no game plan for the next show because we don't know exactly when we're going to get together. So what's a big movie coming up this year that's already a bus movie, even if it's months away? Do you know any offhand, Paul? All right, the Lunar New Year was like the bus, and now all bus is gone for the rest of the year.
Yeah, Lunar New Year kind of took up my time. There's some things on the horizon, but nothing really huge.
There's a couple Andy Lau movies.
Andy Lau's got... I saw a trailer for one Andy Lau movie that's coming that looks really heavy. I don't know if I'll...
Yeah, that's the one where he's looking for his missing kid, right?
Yeah. That looks kind of... that might be too heavy for me to do a cinema screening of. and which is a shame because I love Andy so much. Mm-hmm. But when a movie's like that, it's about family and kids, especially kids.
Yeah.
I'm in a place right now where that kind of stuff just tears me up, and I don't know if I could take that in the cinema. I think there's a Soy Hark movie coming.
Yeah,
I think
Tiger Mountain.
Taking of Tiger Mountain was actually released in China in December, I want to say, and we haven't gotten it in Hong Kong yet as an official screening, so that will be coming. They've got the Hong Kong International Film Festival coming up, so that's like what everybody's talking about currently at the time we're recording this, and that's kind of put blinders on everything else in terms of discussion.
You know what's next for Donnie, for instance? Do we even know that?
Ip Man 3. I think it was just announced. He apparently needs to lose 30 pounds or something like that.
There's a trailer playing now in cinemas for a Chow Yun-Fat movie with Sylvia Chang.
Oh yeah, that's a musical, the Johnny Koh musical.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be about like high society, you know, rich people and stuff.
Certainly, Chow Yun-Fat and Sylvia Chang back in the Johnny Toe fold for the first time since, God, could it be since '89 with All About Along? Could it be that?
I think so.
Yeah.
Wow. Times have changed, like from between the Thunderlock and the Tycoon, and all respective careers. They've gone through good changes, of course, but man, that's a long time ago. Like pre-Sylvia being a director, I think.
Despite that being a ripoff of the Eddie Murphy movie, I still love that movie.
What about that long ripoff? Thunderlock and the Tycoon.
Thunderlock and the Tycoon, yeah. Right. It's such a ripoff of Coming to America, but it's still, I just love it.
Right on. Well, let's put a cap to this Dynasty Report. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for bringing your knowledge and your views on these movies when I can't. And it allows me to, as I said, sit back and enjoy the ride and be disruptive every now and again. So hopefully everybody enjoyed. So we'll sign off after some brief contact information again. And this has been The Dynasty Report on Podcast on Fire. We are on podcastonfire.com along with all the other shows and bonus episodes. So make your pick, take your pick. If you have any questions and or feedback about this show or any other show, podcastonfire@googlemail.com. We also are available on Facebook if you want to chat with us there. Like our page, facebook.com/PUF Network. The discussion group is reachable by typing in Podcast on Fire Network in the Facebook search box. And our Twitter handle is @PodcastOnFire. I continue writing about old-timey Taiwanese movies and Category 3 movies and ninja movies and various other Hong Kong movies and various genres at SoGoodReviews.com, and I video review at SleazyKVideo.com, and my Twitter handle is @SoGoodReviews. And we are also on iTunes, as we mentioned. Rate and subscribe, and if you have the time, please leave a written comment. We would love to see some more reviews up there, and a small one will do as a review. One or two sentences is what Apple will accept in terms of user reviews up there. And finally, stream us on Stitcher Radio, either via their website, but the smoothest way to do so is on the application, via the application on Apple App Store and Google Play. And your other podcast, Paul, Your Home Away From Home, is what? So people know again.
I do a show called East Screen, West Screen, where right now we just primarily focus on East Screen Hong Kong films, trying to do at least one film a week. And you can find all of that over at our website, kongcast.com. That's KONGCAST.com.
Yeah, just the thought of one big movie that should be coming out in Hong Kong this year, regardless if we do it here or you do it on your shore. The Jackie Chan movie, Dragon Blade, right?
Oh, Dragon Blade, yeah. I think that's coming out in about a week from the time of this recording.
Doing big business in China, like you read about. John Cusack, Adrian Brody, and Jackie Chan. In a movie that's, I don't know what critics thought of it, but man, that's blowing up like you read about on the mainland.
Really?
Like it earned the equivalent of, I think, over 100 million US. I might be wrong. It was big. Either 50 or 100. I remember reading an article about it. Like an article about this is the biggest, like Adrian Brody, John Cusack, Jackie Chan movie is the biggest movie in China that's like, and like challenging Hollywood blockbusters and yada, yada, yada. It was some Variety article giving it some space. And it, I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I don't know. But I always thought it looked like, really? Okay. Mm-hmm. But and again, being a judgmental prick beforehand again. So there you go. That's surely coming to Hong Kong. So that's material I think you're going to hear on a podcast featuring Paul Fox regardless, because obviously it's a big movie that maybe deserves to watch, regardless if you're a big Jackie Chan fan or not, Paul. So that's that. Concast, and your significant Twitter plug, David Lambs. So go ahead.
Yeah, please find me on Twitter @TideYuppie. That's it.
Doodling away, daily or semi-daily or...
You got it.
Not often enough for my taste.
Not often enough. I don't know. You know, I try.
I like when your inspiration hits you, and it's really like... makes me humbled, because sometimes you listen to one of our obscure shows like a Taiwan Noir and what have you, and did some like amazing, to me amazing, and probably a 5-minute job for you, like a doodle of some Taiwanese star that I'm way too in love with, and just put out there and show us, and that's like inspiring creativity, my friends. I hope you, like, whenever something creative and inspiring hits you, that you hit your trusty old pen or do some computer art, if you will, or old school, like never, like no paint program, it's all done by pen, man.
You know, I'm very quick, pen and paper. Yeah.
Cave paintings.
Cave paintings, yeah. Pretty much.
So go check it out. Links are all available in the show post. But for the moment, thank you very much for listening to Podcast on Fire's Dynasty Report. So I've been Kenny B. With me was Paul Fox. So say bye, buddy.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
And David Lamb, of course. So you have the honor of being the last voice on the show. So make it important.
Thank you for inviting me again onto the show. Paul, thank you for gracing us with your sexy voice. Ken, as always, your knowledge just blows my mind.
but you are a judgmental prick, so there is that.